You're listening to the News Project Podcast for the week of June 21st, 2021, brought to you by GNET TV. This podcast brings you these stories. Then and Now, Lot 20, and Lucy Prince, and the new Founders Hall at BBA.
Lucy Terry Prince was a remarkable woman. Enslaved at a young age and brought to the American colonies as a young child in the late 1720s or early 1730s, she lived in the area around Deerfield, Massachusetts. It was there that she composed a poem about a raid staged by a group of indigenous Americans against a group of European settlers, and she titled it Bar's Fight. More than 100 years later, it was published in a newspaper based in Springfield, Massachusetts, and that was the first recorded publication of a work of literature by an African American. Although Lucy was reputedly a prolific writer, none of her other works have survived. Bar's Fight did by oral tradition, handed down by one generation to another verbally, before its publication in 1854. Her life's journey eventually brought her to Sunderland, Vermont, where she lived out the last 24 years of her life. Her remarkable story includes arguing and winning a case brought to the Vermont Supreme Court, where she persuaded the court to honor her original claim to the property in Sunderland. Earlier, in the 1750s, the man she married, Abijah Prince, bought her freedom, and they came to live in Guilford, Vermont, and there raised a family of six children. Abijah was an entrepreneurial, hard-working man who was one of the original proprietors or landowners of Sunderland when the townships of Vermont were first being laid out and chartered in the 1760s. He owned property in Guilford as well and never wound up living in Sunderland, but Lucy did. Lucy Prince passed away on July 11, 1821, and with this year being the 200th anniversary of her passing, the town of Sunderland has adopted a proclamation, which has been followed by a state resolution, honoring one of its foremost citizens, whom many people have probably never heard of. Over the past few months, a group of local residents have tried to answer two questions. Was Lucy buried in Sunderland? Maybe. Town records are inconclusive. But now, another mystery has been clarified. Where was her property located? After extensive research, it appears it was located in an area accessed off of Ondua Road and near the present-day railroad line and Sunderland Hill Road. Jeff Dexter and Jim and Avis Hayden have dug deep to find the spot of the Negro Lot, as it was referred to in town records, and we met up with them in the Sunderland Town Hall recently to learn more.
The town of Sunderland was formed in about 1765, and Abijah was an original proprietor. There were 60 original proprietors, and to get on the proprietor list, you had to pay Governor Wentworth £100, and it was sort of like a political payoff. Once you were on that list, you could draw from a hat every time they did a subdivision. And I think they did five subdivisions in Sunderland to cover all of the land mass. But the first subdivision that they did included Lucy's lot. Abijah drew from a hat, Lot 20. And so our challenge was to find Lot 20. So what we did is we realized that the 50-acre lots that were laid out uniformly in the first subdivision were exactly 50-acre lots. 100 rods on the bottom of the lot, wide, and high, it was 80 lots. They were all uniform, just like that. So, Lucy's lot being Lot 20, we simply took the distance from the Arlington line to the northwest corner of Lot 20, which was four lots or 400 rods. We know how long a rod is, so we measured that. Did the same thing from the Manchester line, which was two lots down, so 160 rods. And at that's how we got the northwest point of Lot 20. And it took quite a while to do that. Because the original plat maps weren't complete. The one I got originally wasn't complete. And then we got a complete one, and we were able to do it.
But the original map, see, like this one, which is what the town has, doesn't have any bearings on it. It doesn't have any landmarks, although you can kind of see the Battenkill River up there. But it was really hard to go from. So a cousin of mine was able to superimpose this plat map over a Google Earth map of the town of Sunderland so that you can see, he could key off this northwest corner where Arlington and Manchester come together. And you can find lot 20, and then you can see where it is in the present day.
The original proprietors, the 60 proprietors, were strictly land speculators. And they just drew that lot from the hat, and they went out with the surveyor and found out where it was. They set their corners, and then they set up business. I'm selling land. And so they sold to farmers. So the new settlers came in as farmers, and they just cleared the land.
And many of them, maybe most, were not Sunderland residents.
Exactly.
Correct.
They were, most of them, outside businessmen, land speculators.
Right.
That's how they made their money.
Which is where Abijah, again, he was from Guilford. That's where his home site is and was, but would farm this land before, I think, he sold it. He sold some of it.
He probably sold much of it, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. He may have kept lot 20 for his children. We don't know that.
Yeah, we don't know. He had several pieces of land. So one other little interesting historical tidbit is the person who wound up with lot 21 was a gentleman named Amos Chipman, C-H-I-P-M-A-N. And before the rights to lot 20 were ever straightened out, and Lucy and her family had a place to live, they were living with Amos Chipman on lot 21, at least according to the 1800 census. And the other thing about Mr. Chipman, and we found this old survey, which also helped us in determining some of the geographical references for the map, is that he set up on his land a grist mill, and he also set up a sawmill, which is along, what's that called, Mill Brook.
It's Sunderland Borough.
Yeah, it's what we know today as Sunderland Borough, but it's along the Mill Brook. Those two mills were set up, so that formed the like nucleus of the town at the beginning.
And in that survey, it mentions, or in paperwork associated with the survey, it mentions adjacent to the Negro lot.
Right.
So his lot was 21. The
Lucy's
Negro lot is 20.
So what do we make of Lucy's sort of place in history overall, and in Sunderland's in particular? Obviously, that she was the first, as we understand it, the first published African American poet or writer of any kind, and she also was involved in a couple of high-profile law cases. Arguments before the Vermont Supreme Court to ensure her property rights, as I understand it.
Right.
I guess to ask probably a silly question, what makes her unusual or interesting or, you know, kind of worth learning more about?
Well, I would say the fact that, the era that we're looking at and how much she overcame coming over from Africa as about a five-year-old child being stolen from her parents, going to different families in New England, but highly intelligent, a religious person, and then to be able to, you know, achieve all that she achieved in terms of, as you say, the court battles, from harassment of neighbors down in Guilford to the illegal taking of her land up here for tax purposes in Sunderland, arguing her case. Again, not formally educated beyond, maybe an elementary type education, but just the intelligence, the ability to communicate so well with in a court setting, her storytelling prowess is legendary. People would come from miles to listen to her talking about the life experiences she had right up to the day she died. Again, it's, you know, raising a family as a widow for many years, a farming person, having a farming industry business too. So, yeah, just the accomplishments, and again, in the time of the beginning of our country, for a African American woman to achieve are just, in my eyes, amazing. And I think Sunderland is very proud that she is was a former resident of our good town.
There are a couple of points also that in terms of the why this wasn't sold to new settlers. I think, as Jeff mentioned, it probably was not sold. This particular lot was probably not sold. I think Abijah probably held it in reserve, but he died. And nobody lived here. And all of a sudden they see this huge lot 20 with 50 acres on prime farmland. And when it came up for taxes, nobody paid the taxes. Lucy probably wasn't notified over in Guilford. And so a Mr. Brownson bought the property for taxes. Lucy came over here, found out that it was owned by another person, appealed it to the Supreme Court, won the case, but since Brownson bought it legally, it was his. But as I understand it, the Supreme Court awarded Lucy $200 or said to the town, make this right. Is that your understanding,
yes,
Jeff?
Yes.
And so what happened, and we have the deed of this, is the town of Sunderland paid Mr. Brownson $200 for 18 acres of lot 20. The town owned it, but Lucy had the right to live there as long as she lived.
Lucy and her heirs had the right to live there, and that's why the property stayed in the family until the last one of them died.
And one other thing that I wanted to mention is we got a great deal of information from this book, Mr. and Mrs. Prince, How an Extraordinary 18th Century Family Moved Out of Slavery and Into Legend. This was Gretchen Gerzina. Her husband Anthony also helped. A number of years ago, they published this book after a great deal of research throughout Vermont, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, everywhere. And we really have to say that without this book, we wouldn't have had anywhere near as much information as we needed. And so if anyone else is interested, this is a great book to get. It's not only historically great to read, but it's one of those that you can't put down, because as Avis said, you learn so much more about these individual family members and what they did for the United States and in general, and in the Vermont in particular. So a great book to have.
The town of Guilford is also expected to host an observance of the bicentennial of her passing. History is filled with many surprises. The Princes were surely among the first African Americans and former slaves to own property in Vermont. They also faced intense hostility in several of the places they lived. Lucy and her husband's lives were two black lives that indeed mattered. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Founders Hall, a 25,000-square-foot building that's been under construction since last June, behind the main seminary and Rowland Center buildings on the campus of Burn Burton Academy, is nearing completion. A ribbon cutting and an opening ceremony is being planned for August 21st. Once it's finished, the building will house the school's English and Social Studies departments, as well as the school's library. It will also house a makerspace. The keynote of the building may be its sweeping staircase and atrium, which on clear days at least, will offer some ready-for-your-cell-phone photo opportunities. Turn around, and the view back towards the school's signature bell tower will be equally compelling for many. This top level of the building, which houses the bell tower room, will be a conference center and a meeting space. Back last May, we had a chance to follow Headmaster Mark Tashin around the building as he described what the various spaces will be used for.
The lead architect on this project is Kyle Murphy, who was a graduate in 2007. We charged Kyle with two overarching objectives. Number one was to design a building that looked to the future while honoring the past. And number two was to create a building that fit uniquely into its setting. That was from an aesthetic standpoint. And then, obviously, from a working standpoint, it has to work internally as a center for integrated studies. So inside this building, we're going to have English, social studies, a beautiful library that climbs up a three-story atrium, and then we'll have a makerspace, a STEAM lab. So it will integrate those disciplines, and our whole proposition is that architecture can support a new way of approaching education. So if you look behind me while I'm on a roll, I'm going to ask you to direct the camera up at the building. You can see a couple of key features. The first thing I want you to notice is that the mountain, which has always been prominent, a prominent part of Burn Burton, remains prominent. So Kyle designed a building that frames the mountain and actually enhances our view of the mountain rather than detracts from it. The building itself is clad in Vermont slate, and so we wanted to have a natural material, but a new way of using a traditional material. And then as we go in, you'll see that there's this grand space up at the top. We call it the bell tower room. And when completed, it will have giant floor-to-ceiling windows and will allow you to look out over the bell tower, which is kind of a symbol of our history. Look over the bell tower and onto the East Mountains. It's going to climb up these risers, up three stories, and kids will be able to flop around on, these are stairs that are designed to be sat on. So it's a little bit inspired by the European piazzas, but you climb up the stairs, and then there will also be platforms where we have more traditional seatings, tables and chairs. And then down here, there'll be tables and chairs, couches, lounge furniture. One of the ideas for how we outfit this building is that there are different strokes for different folks. And one thing we've learned is that kids, and actually people, have different tastes in how they like to sit and where they want to work. And so we want to provide a building that has all different kinds of seating so that if you're informal and you want to flop around and half lie down, you can do that. If you want to sit at a table, you can do that. If you want to sit in a lounge chair, you can do that. If you want to sit in a stool, kind of Starbucks style, you can do that. So different strokes for different folks. The other thing is the building itself is organized into four different neighborhoods. And the idea is we create learning neighborhoods, and I'll explain that when we go in. Okay. So we're now in our first learning neighborhood. A learning neighborhood is comprised of a common room, and then we have classrooms that are arranged off of the common space. So one of the architectural concepts was rather than have a long hallway and classrooms off of the hallway, we create a larger room and have the classrooms off of that room. That way the room itself, you can think of this as three hallways all stacked together, it becomes a much more usable space. We can put furniture in here and it allows flow through, but it also gives students a place to work. So when they're in a classroom, they can spill out and use this common space. Over here, you can see we have a garage door. And this is our answer to the removable wall. You pull it down, you have a separate classroom, you pull it up, and we've enhanced this space and created a larger space. Over here, if you look out the window, one of Kyle's propositions is that great architecture makes you look at what's around it differently. And so he specifically said he didn't want to design a look at me building. He wanted to design a building that allowed us to look at other things and see them differently. So here we have our bell tower, very nicely framed. And you'll see other views of our buildings and of the mountains and the valley. And again, that's all part of an intentional design to see what's around us rather than just focus on the building itself. So now we're on the second floor. We'll have counter seating here, looking out over the library and this, again, this grand atrium space. And then when we come in here, we'll be coming into another learning neighborhood. This is the common space. And in this case, we have two classrooms off of this learning neighborhood. So it's a smaller learning neighborhood. Then we'll walk down the hall. Over here is our teacher collaboration space. They can be inspired again by the views of the bell tower. And then you can see again, we're creating all these open views. And at the top of the library common area, that will be a floor-to-ceiling window that will be looking out on the mountain. So that should be quite dramatic once we get rid of all this scaffolding. Big, spacious, high ceilings. We have exposed workings of the building. We want kids to know, and we want anyone to know, this is how the building works. I think all too often we hide the working part of the building, and in this case, we want people to be able to see how the building is carrying air and supporting itself. So check out this view. Looking out on the mountains, down the valley, and you can start to see that we're starting to be able to look up over the bell tower building, the seminary building, and see the mountains behind it. There'll be more of that as we go up further. See all the exposed mechanicals with the acoustic ceiling. That's all on purpose. And then each classroom has a teaching wall, which will have this nice accent color and projector, and then there'll be whiteboards on either side. Part of the seminary building, and we're bringing our access program right up into the heart of campus. And that way those kids will be able to spill right out on the courtyard and they'll be in the heart of campus and, you know, fully immersed in our community.
The former parking area behind the school will become a courtyard. Construction on the $20 million project, a philanthropic gift of Barry and Wendy Rowland, is on track. The lead architect of the project is Kyle Murphy, a member of the school's graduating class of 2007. He spoke with us in May about his thinking and the development of the project, which is intended to honor the school's past while also pointing a direction for the future.
Anytime you're doing any sort of institutional academic work, it's like you're balancing the needs and wishes of so many people. It's like we had, 70 faculty that we had to kind of, I don't know if it was that many. It was quite a few people that were involved in our workshops. And it's always about kind of distilling down all of the requests and, you know, opinions that we're getting into like a kind of a hierarchy of, you know, what's most important in the building. Like, how do we kind of satisfy the biggest things and at the same time be creative about, you know, creating spaces that can be flexible and can serve more than one use. So we're not kind of siloing one department or one type of use into the building. There's kind of a social sustainability aspect to the project, where it's like, how sustainable is it in terms of the use? Is that it's gonna set the stage for generations to come? So I think that was something that was very much on our mind. The other one I would say is the site itself. It's incredible the way it's like straddling between the bottom of the mountain and the existing campus. So it's this amazing opportunity to, you know, as we've we've started saying it's like we're kind of bridging the history of the school into like what is the future, but at the same time honoring the past that we're coming from. What makes that site so incredible is that we're kind of connecting up to that upper part of the campus. So we really had this opportunity to create kind of like a thoroughfare through the building that will come up through that main stair, and we'll give that connection up to that upper part of the campus. So it's, you know, I think that in that sense it'll be successful, but it's not so much about, I mean, even though the building is very different than anything that's on the campus, we're not really so interested in creating kind of a look at me building. I think it's more about like the views that we're framing from the inside and getting people maybe to look at, you know, for instance, the bell tower, where that top room is going to look like. Maybe, you know, you're seeing that in a new light from a new vantage point. And I would hope that would instill a lot of pride in the school, both in the students and the faculty.
The ambitious project, launched in the midst of the COVID pandemic when uncertainty about what lay ahead was at its height, will soon be serving its multiple educational purposes and open just in time to welcome students returning from summer vacation. For the GNOW TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.TV.